Hello! Welcome to episode 52 of Jughead's Basement, featuring lo-fi interviews with hi-fi guests. This week, Luke McNeil. Before we launch into one of his songs from the copyrights, I would like to say thank you to my new Patreons who've just signed up, Mark Gartner, Ben Osman, and William Bernath. I graduated from the school of no knocks. I graduated from the school of no knocks. Now I'm down on my knees. Welcome to Jughead's Basement, episode 52 with Luke McNeil. Lo-fi interviews with hi-fi guests. Right now you're listening to the copyright song, No Knocks, from their EP on Fat Records called No Knocks, put out in 2014. Today we talk to Luke McNeil, who is the singer-songwriter for both Hospital Job and Copyrights, and he plays drums in Copyrights and guitar in Hospital Job, plus many, many, many other instruments and capabilities within the construct of managing and performing in a band. And we talk about all of that, plus we talk about his job as a lawyer and how he tried to help the problem that punk bands often have at the borders of different countries with artist exemptions and being turned away. So we talk about that. We talk about Hospital Job and songwriting and about his relationship with Adam Fletcher and copyrights. Plus, since him and I are sort of gabby-gabby friends, he of course got me talking about Screeching Weasel, Ben Weasel, and also about Even in Blackouts. So please listen and pay attention and think. Here's Luke McNeil.
Did you get to talk to Adam?
I did, and that went really well. I don't think I've talked to him in years. I was thinking about it, and I probably know you far more well than Adam.
Couple sessions at Sonic Iguana and stuff.
Yeah. I tend to run into you a lot more than I do Adam. So
there's like people working on my roof. I can't believe it coincided exactly when this. When this podcast was happening, but if it's too noisy, just let me know. I can move to the basement or whatever.
So Luke, I think I'm already recording. So yeah. So we got gold already. So I'm trying to keep these more casual, but I do have notes and stuff. I just, I'm not able to commit to my huge dissecting of like a single record as much. So I'm more into just interviewing people individually. And once I did Adam, I was like, oh, I should probably do Luke too, just because it seems like it's a sort of different way to look at the same band. And also you both have different sort of histories. And even though the two of you have worked together forever, like since you were, you know, teens, you've both gone on and done other projects separately. So I thought it was a good opportunity to let the audience know of what you two share and what you don't share. So
we started if this is literally what Adam said, then
don't worry about that. I like when things are repeated because they're always done slightly differently anyway, so don't even think about that aspect of it.
We started in I think it was like his freshman year. So he just got to high school and I was a year older. I had a few friends that got me into the basic Minor Threat, Misfits, kind of whatever was fast was kind of cool stuff. And he showed up with the first day I saw him, he had a Black Flag shirt on. And for some reason I'd never heard them, but I thought the logo was super cool. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I bet they're a punk band. And I got to talking to him, and then we ended up hanging out with all the same people and stuff, but I knew how to play drums and he had a bass, so we decided to start playing.
What year was that you were a sophomore then, you say?
94 maybe, 93. I look at that, I wasn't around for the very start of the initial punk phase, but I think of the mid 90s as the literal golden age of punk. I think more people were into it then than any other time. in history with Green Day and all that stuff. And I would say Green Day was way more mainstream than any Ramones era punk band, don't you?
I would agree to that. I mean, being on a label, I would imagine in the 70s was much more difficult because there was less labels and they dominated everything and they probably dictated what you sounded like more often. So it was probably harder for a punk band to get into that. But I don't know, but the Sex Pistols and the Ramones and that sort of combination. Yeah. I would imagine it was still bigger because Green Day was like the biggest band in the world of any genre, probably.
Right. Like, I don't think Ramones ever had a number one record or anything, right?
Not that I know of. People think I'm a Ramones historian, but I don't. No.
Hello, this is Jughead. After the interview with Luke McNeil, I went online and I tried to find the Billboard charts for Ramones, and I think I got it correct. And I think Luke was correct that they never hit number one. They never even got into the top 10, according to this Billboard magazine. They had three songs in the top Hot 100, which was Rockaway Beach in 78, Sheen is a Punk Rocker in 77, and Do You Wanna Dance in 78. And according to anything else I've seen, the only thing that even came close to the Hot 100 was Pet Sematary, but it didn't make it into the 100. So I don't know. In the comments, if you think this is wrong, let us know.
Well, I tried to go through a couple of interviews I've seen you've done in the past, and I wouldn't say you're exactly like me, but I admire this about you. You tend to just go through the bullshit and just, you know, you just sort of lay things out pretty nicely. I think that's because you come from I didn't know you were as much of a writer as you are, Luke. I wasn't even aware that you were the writer for the lyrics for Copyrights at all.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I write probably, well, now I write all of the songs, but for the first couple of records, I wrote probably 75 or 80%.
Yeah. And,
I mean, the songs that Adam and Brett wrote are also hits, but they just were not as plentiful in the writing department. And like the last few albums I've written everything. So
I was going to, that's one of the things that we just sort of touched on with Adam that I wanted to explore with you is the idea of writing for someone else to sing. Cause in Hospital Job, you probably do more singing now, right?
And I do. Yeah. I write and play everything in that band, like on the records.
Yeah. Yeah. So what is, what do you think you learned through writing for someone else, through someone else's, was you conscious of how you were doing it, or is it just here's a song?
Yeah, kind of, especially now that we have, since the digital age is upon us and I have recording stuff, I've for the last few albums I've just kind of recorded the version of a song by myself and then sent it to Adam and Brett and Kevin or whatever, and I mean they add to it, you know, but the bones are pretty much the same. So that's the way it's been going lately.
Yeah. I'm trying to hit specifically on the idea of lyrics, like writing.
Okay.
How's it feel to put words into someone else's mouth? Do you consider that at all when you're writing it?
I don't really. I would say like I started Hospital Job for like the weirder lyrics and the weirder music that I wouldn't do. And I mean, it's the same songwriter, so it's going to sound pretty similar, but, I would say like the Copyrights lyrics, I guess, tend to be more vague or universal or whatever than the Hospital Job lyrics are a little bit more personal, I'd say, but I don't know. I don't really think about Adam singing them instead of myself, if that's what you're getting at.
Yeah. I just wondered, I writing is so interesting because it's hard to dissect it sometimes because it's all like a feeling or, you know, it's all caught up in emotions and feelings and sort of instinct. So it's hard to try to dissect that sometimes.
Did you write like when Even in Blackouts was going, did you write the lyrics or did Liz?
I wrote all the lyrics. Well, when Gub came in the band, we started splitting lyrics, but Liz has no interest. We tried to get her to write, but she has no interest in it whatsoever. And that's what kind of why I asked, because in the early days, I would sit there with her and go over like all the lyrics in each line. And she really enjoyed it. I mean, it was really a nice time to get to know her. Like, I would invite her over separately and we would go through all these songs.
That sounds like hell. That would be so awkward. Like, that'd be so awkward to do, I think, with Adam or anybody else, really. But
well, you guys probably know each other. What I told Adam is that eventually, like, I couldn't see doing that now. I mean, we know each other so well after so many years that there's almost no need to do that anymore, you know?
Yeah, so. Yeah, definitely. Me and Adam are pretty, we have a pretty good shorthand for, he can probably guess with 75% accuracy what the next note's going to be in a new song, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Also, having Liz as a singer who can sing, like, I don't, you know, better than anybody else. Yeah. I know. I always feel challenged to challenge myself, which is nice, to so that she has something to dig her teeth into.
Do you ever talk to the brothers? Are they don't play in Even in Blackouts anymore, do they?
No, I just talked to Brad yesterday. We're all
Brad, yeah, and actually, who was the other one?
Brad and Dan.
Dan.
Yeah.
I like those dudes.
Yeah, I do. I like them a lot too. It's actually, we were just, our 20th anniversary is coming up at the beginning of next year. So if things go back to normal, I was talking about getting everyone together, like Phil Hill and
2022
those two and Lumley. Yeah. And do like all anyone who's been in the band. Cause we all still get along. Like, they show up to shows that we do and stuff like that. So it
That's
all
our 20th
out.
Too.
Yeah. 20. We started one of our first show was with Copyrights.
That was your first show?
Well, like, first show out of the city. We did like a couple
that
songs.
That was our first out of town show too. And it was, we just had Brett's Ford Ranger, which was a stick. So one of us had like a stick shift in their crotch the whole way to where Nashville and like Columbus or something. Right.
Yeah.
Like a little weekender. Yeah. Those were our first out of town shows back when we were still a three piece.
Yeah, because I was talking to I did a interview with all.
I don't remember the shows at all.
We did that. I remembered after I talked to Adam about it. We were supposed to play at Lost Cross, but that was one of the shows that actually got, someone made the mistake of putting the address or stuff on the flyers and it got shut down. And then we did it at, what was it, Bogies, Blowies, the sub.
Oh, Boobies.
Boobies. Yeah.
Yeah, that was hit or miss. Like, it could be a good vibe. Outside is always like a sketchy place to play, you know. Like, it could be the worst environment or it could be somewhat okay. I don't know. I don't like outside shows that much.
But I don't know. I know we played more than that together because I remember being inside a venue and seeing you guys like properly. I don't know where it was though.
Well, I mean, the show was in Nashville, the first one. I know that because I was still, I don't know if Teen Idols were still a band, but I was like all stoked to like, oh, maybe they're from Nashville. Maybe they'll be there or something like that. But I don't even know if they were still a band or at that point or not, but they probably didn't even live there anymore.
Yeah. They were still a band because we played one of their last shows in Minneapolis with Dillinger Four. We played with Dillinger Four. I think Vapid band was in around then too played. It was a really good bill, Teen Idols, and they just, you could tell they were, this was the last stand. I love that band dearly, Teen Idols.
Those first two records I still know by like every word by heart, I'd say.
Yeah, I'm the same way. Yeah, those two are very strong records. I keep on trying to get Phil. Maybe I'll keep trying to get him on here.
I think Adam's in contact with him. I'm kind of off the grid now. I don't have social media anymore. So
yeah,
I feel like I miss a lot, but I think Adam's still in contact with Phil.
Yeah. I just talked to him. I'm still in contact with him. You're in Springfield now. When did you make that move? What is your trajectory of band and location?
Dude, we're all over the place now. Kevin's in Chicago. I'm in Springfield. Adam's still in Carbondale and Brett's in Nashville. We span quite a ways, unfortunately, but even when all four of us were in Carbondale, I don't think we even practiced that much. So get together, rehearse, and then go on tour if we do it again, you know? treading water since this pandemic, obviously, but I don't know if you're still trying to tour or if you're doing more acting stuff now, but I think bands like in our range are going to be the worst hit by this, because a lot of the places we would play aren't going to make it through, like in towns.
Yeah.
And then the places that do are going to be competing. They're going to be bombarded with bigger bands than us that can draw a lot more people asking for shows every night of the week. You know what I mean?
Even more than any music genre. I think the punk genre is really about the sort of that relationship with the audience too. So, so there's a lot of breathing the same air going on at punk shows.
Oh yeah. The least ventilated, least sanitary rooms in the country, I'd say.
Yeah. And like you're saying, most venues don't have a big budget. So they're going, you know, a lot of them are going under.
Yeah. And then even like some of the bigger ones are going to go under. So some of the bands that are on the borderline for playing bigger places, they're going to go down to the smaller places that are still there. Obviously take any free nights. And I don't know, it's probably going to be pretty tough for a while if you're looking to actively tour, which I don't think we are really. Everybody's got their own stuff. I'm a full-time attorney. Adam's a full-time dad now. I think they have two kids now. Mm-hmm. And Brett's a full-time artist, and Kevin's in a full-time real band, Off With Their Heads. So it's going to be a few and far between when we do play, I think.
You became an engineer, and you became a lawyer, and you were in a band and the writer. How did you, do you have more hours in a day than most people, or what's your, you're married and have kids?
No, I don't have kids.
Oh, you don't?
No kids. No.
Oh, you have dogs.
Four legged kids, two St. Bernards.
Sorry about that. I was kind of tired when I got to your house. That's right. You had all the dogs. That's right.
Yeah. It was all a whim. Sonic Iguana. I tried to do that. Like, that's the only, I don't know why I didn't move to the coast or something like that, but the only Midwestern place that I had any connection with was Sonic Iguana for recording wise. And I just couldn't pay the bills working there. I mean, it was too sporadic of projects. And I decided, there's a law school in Carbondale. I'll just take the LSAT one day. And I did really well on it and got a scholarship opportunity to go to Carbondale, SIU Carbondale. And they offered me a scholarship. And I said, well, this is too good of an opportunity to pass up. But literally, like, everybody in my class had the same scholarship. So I don't think it was too too rare of an opportunity, you know.
Yeah.
Kind of got fleeced there, I think. But I don't know. It worked out.
What's your venue for a lawyer? Kind of, I don't even know what to say. What's your
criminal? I do criminal appeals, so like the appellate court and the Illinois Supreme Court kind of stuff. And I'm working from home right now, so
yeah. Criminal appeals, is that a lot of paperwork? Are you actually in court?
Not very. I'm in court like once a month. It's almost all written briefs.
That's the real life. I mean, there's some enjoyment in that for you. What do you get out of that, do you think, besides money?
No, I wouldn't want to do any other. The reason I took this job, honestly, was for the music thing. I was stupid and asked if I could have time off for touring, like during the second job interview, you know?
Yeah.
And my boss is like, yeah, criminal appeals is like, if you ask for a continuance for a month, it's no big deal. So if you want to tour for like 30 days, that isn't going to throw a wrench into the gears or anything. So I was like, I'm sold. So I moved. That's why we live in Springfield, because this is where that job is. And then my wife she's a vet, and she found a job here at a clinic, and she just got she's getting her COVID vaccine soon. So
this seems like a band that this was all right, but it's really interesting that sometimes you couldn't go out with copyrights because they had to have another drummer fill in. Does that feel weird when that first happened? It just seemed like it's my band, but I can't be there, so it's okay.
Yeah, it did. I mean, in the schematic, like in the grand scheme of things, the easiest. I mean, what difference does it make who plays boom ching boom boom ching, like all night, you know? Yeah. And I mean, I'm not that good of a drummer anyway. So the other drummers that played took my place, I'm sure, were better. But yeah, they couldn't kick me out because they're all my songs. So I was kind of selfish, I guess, for I remember telling Brett and Adam that I was going to law school, and they were like, what? So that was kind of, I'm like, yeah, I'm going to be pretty busy for the next 3 years. So that was, and that was right when I think Mutiny Pop was happening. So it was kind of a bad time to not be able to tour at all, but they took it in stride, I guess. That's I don't know who, what kind of bands you talk to on here, like bigger bands, I'm sure. But with us, and it's probably partially my fault. I feel like I never took the band. I never went all in, you know what I mean? I never did the band full time, which for better or worse, I guess.
Yeah. I talked to Adam a little bit, not much more from a different angle of, I talked to him about, way back when, Weasel was doing our tours. We had been, playing those venues where you play in front of four or five people and you just try to get from town to town without, breaking down. But then one time we hit Philadelphia and we went from literally zero audiences to 300 or 400 people. It was one of those literal nice. Overnight when the Lookout, My Brain Hurts came out. Awesome. But then I think what people forget is that you have that long history of the years before, because that was 92 and we had been, me and Ben were working together since 86, 87. So
that was real risky touring, and you didn't have GPS or internet or phones or anything like that back then,
Yeah. I talk a lot about how you get to a venue and sometimes it's canceled and the guy standing there is like, it's canceled. Sorry. It's like,
oh, great. Why didn't you email me?
Yeah, so there's no, with Ben, we had these really strict rules, which was kind of, looking back, it's kind of fun dealing with it, but I'm the one who had to deal with it since I was the manager. So we had all these, we had to have monitors, and requesting monitors at punk shows in the late 80s, early 90s was pulling teeth. So we'd get to a place and they wouldn't have any, and Ben would start walking away, and I'm in the middle going, oh my God, how am I going to make this? Where can we go to someone's house? Do you have some house speakers or some DJ speakers we can use or something?
If he's the one who wanted him, why didn't he mess with it?
Well, sometimes the people that put the rules in place don't actually like to be in charge of them.
I hear that. I was a huge, obviously we were all Screeching Weasel fans. You guys didn't live on the road or anything, did you? Or did you tour a bunch?
In the first few years, once we could figure out how to tour, book it ourselves, we did, but it wasn't the longest tour we ever did was a 4 week. And then we came home for 2 days and then went out another 4 weeks. So
pretty good.
We would go two or three times a year, but then I think after Anthem, it just stopped cold. Ben stopped, his anxiety sort of built to a peak where we couldn't do it anymore.
I feel like a lot of the Chicago earlier punk bands didn't tour as much as maybe the coast bands. I don't know, Naked Ray Gun, and I feel like they should have been, a household name, No Effects or something, Sick of It All from New York or something like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, exactly. I would even say that to them. It's like never left. They did occasionally. They did went out and did a special show in New York or something over there, but they didn't.
Right.
They weren't a touring band. They were a blue collar working band in Chicago, and it was so amazing to be in Chicago and see these huge, thousands of people in a pit, like 1,000 people in a pit. And then no one else in the rest of the country knows who this band is. It's both special and kind of frustrating.
Right. I remember that first, I don't know if it was the first Riot Fest, but the first Riot Fest that they reunited, it was the fucking Beatles. It was, the crowd was huge.
Yeah. 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 They got a lore behind them. They're pretty much the band that sort of bridged the gap between, more than any other Chicago band, I think they bridged the gap between the older punk scene and the newer punk scene. And they actually would often have newer bands open for them and stuff. And I remember we were actually invited to I think it was
Are you guys the newer or the older punk scene, Screeching Weasel?
We were the newer punk scenes. Yeah. Cause they go back to, I don't know, their first record is in 81, 82, 3, somewhere around there.
Some clarifications on Naked Ray Gun here after the fact of the interview with Luke McNeil. Santiago Durango started the band in 1980 with Jeff Pizzati's brother, if I'm not mistaken. Someone who I befriended a little bit later, who was on Throb Throb, Camilo Gonzalez, who wrote Surf Combat. So that band formed technically in 81, and then Haggerty joined in 83. And I think that's all I need to fill in. This isn't about Naked Ray Gun. I just thought that was something I should clarify.
Yeah, so we were invited to Jeff Pizzati's bachelor party, and it was really funny because you go to this, we went to their apartment, and they're sort of all smoking cigars gathered around like a poker table. And it was like Pizzati and the guys from the Effigies. So it was all the old timer Articles of Faith. All those guys were at, we called it like the adult table, and us and this band, Out of Order. Do you remember them? They're like another Chicago band.
Big the for name a little sounds while. Familiar, but yeah.
Yeah. We were all sitting at this little, it was physically a little table.
Like the literal kids table. Yeah.
So we were invited to their party, but we weren't really at the table with them.
Where did was Big Black part of that or no?
Well, Jeff and Steve overlapped a lot, but Steve wasn't there then, but they hung out. But I think, I don't know the history of their like relationships, but they in the beginning days they crossed over quite a lot. Like Steve Albini would go to all of the early Naked Ray Gun shows when it was sort of the different incarnation before John Haggerty was in the band.
Well,
and then they sort of split off. Big Black took its own path, and then Naked Ray Gun took its own path.
Didn't Santiago Durango, is that his name?
Yeah.
Didn't he play in Big Black and Naked Ray Gun? Or
early on, yeah, in the beginning days, yeah.
Is that who John Haggerty replaced?
I think so. I'm going to say that, then okay. I'll correct myself later if it's wrong. But yeah, they had sort of I did a podcast on Throb Throb, which was my favorite record of theirs. But that was sort of their, after that, they sort of went different ways, Haggerty. And they went more into the sort of militaristic sort of sounding band, I would say. And the more artsy stuff sort of went away with Santiago. And so I like that sort of intersection of that. It was really, that first record is bizarre. It's really strong punk, but it's also odd. Like Hospital Job in a way. Like you're doing pretty standard type of music, but there's these odd little...
Strong praise. Section. Thank you.
Yeah. I know. I really, my friend Jen actually introduced me to Hospital Job before I knew you were even in it. And I...
Jen who?
Jen, I can't think of her last name. She's in St. Louis.
Oh, Jen Perkins.
Yeah, Jen Perkins. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I know her.
Yeah. She's a big fan of the band, so she got me listening to you guys.
I was just thinking I haven't seen her in forever, but I guess I haven't seen anyone in forever. So
I know you have to think about what forever means right now. It's like, okay. you know, so Hospital Job, you know, I was Googling that, and I think I learned more about healthcare and nursing jobs than I did about your band.
Dude, we didn't think that one through. Like when I was on Facebook, that's why that was like one of the last reasons I was clinging on to Facebook was because of the Hospital Job. I'm like, oh, well, I'd book any shows that we did, and I need to have contact with people. But literally every message was somebody from India asking for like a job. They thought it was like an employment site. And it was kind of sad, but it's also kind of annoying.
Yeah. It's funny. I had a podcast.
Our numbers up. I'm sure everybody thinks we like bought likes because like half of the likes on the Hospital Job Facebook are from India. I don't So it looks like fake names. You know what I mean?
Yeah. That's funny. Cause I had a podcast before this one called The Hole in 30 Days, where me and my friend would document, we would give ourselves a task at the beginning of the month. And every day we would document our lives on how it affected us. Like one of them was we had to donate time to different causes or stuff. And then one was about rebellion. So we had to like say no a lot to people and stuff like that. So to me, it's like, oh, we took the song 30 Days in the Hole and turned it around, a hole in 30 days. And we use that as our like theme song. But that one, I didn't know there was a diet program called The Hole in 30 Days, which is like Whole Foods in 30 days. So I kept on my podcast like, oh, the numbers are great. It's like, and then they drop off right away. Oh, they think it's a diet program.
This is the worst diet podcast I've ever heard.
So what is that name? What was your thinking of that name?
I needed, like, I've started that band because I wanted to, again, because copyrights are so spread out. And I had a bunch of like somewhat weirder songs that probably weren't going to work as copyright songs. And I wanted to have a local band because I wasn't getting away from Springfield anytime soon. And so I started that band with three people. And I remembered watching Cape Fear a long time ago, the remake with De Niro and Nick Nolte.
Yeah, that's a great
movie. And like, when he's talking to like the guy he pays to beat Robert De Niro's ass, mm-hmm. like the hitman guy, he's like, do you want a morgue job or a hospital job? And he said like hospital job. I'm like, hospital job, that sounds like a cool band name.
Yeah.
So when I was just, I mean, it's a random like two words that I thought sounded kind of tough from a movie.
Not have you that. Let that title or the idea of it, does it affect your writing or the anything about the aspects of it?
No. That's I always thought even a Black House was one of the more clever names. I like that. And I'm glad. I think copyrights is an okay name, but I kind of am jealous of bands with like a really cool name, just because the t-shirts I think will sell so many more if you have a cool name. Like I think Teenage Bottle Rocket's like a cool name, or I think Off With Their Heads is like a fucking amazing
that's a good
band.
One, yeah. Yeah.
And I feel like, I mean, not that we're in the same league as them, but I feel like some people might not want to have a shirt that says the copyrights. I don't know.
What's interesting to me is the, you know, you, from what I learned, you kind of, that was sort of the ironic take on the Malacca Plus was a bunch of different bands because it's a reference, you know, to the movie.
That too, yeah. And from a mistaken, like, you said Malacca Plus, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course, we thought we were way edgy. We were taking this little-known movie called Clockwork Orange. Nobody's going to have know this reference. Of course, there's, like, five bands called Malacca Plus. One of them, like, sends us a cease and desist, and we, like, one offhand idea from the singer of that band was like, we should just call ourselves the copyrights because it's a copyright infringement or something.
Yeah.
And then me and Adam started copyrights later, and I was like, well, and we started it with the direct goal of being sort of, I mean, Screeching Weasel worship, you know, Riverdale's mm-hmm. worship, Ramones worship. And it was supposed to be kind of a side project. And I was like, well, if we're going to do that, like copyrights kind of works, because we're like going to copy these bands the right way or something.
Hmm.
I don't know. That was my thinking anyway.
But I would say one of the different things you did, and maybe this is, I don't know what Sludgeworth is before you, but Dillinger Four, I don't know if is before you guys. Those are the ones I think that have those sort of sing-along group vocals, which isn't as much a Weasel thing or Riverdale's thing as much as it is.
That's true. They were my favorite band after Midwestern Songs came out. Like, that one blew me away. I mean, Screeching Weasel was my favorite band for a long time before that. But I was like, I took that D4 record as like a pretty big sea change for the kind of punk that I liked. And yeah, definitely a big influence. And the sing-along thing that you mentioned, like, that's we try to, like, I never do like a chorus in my production. And I even urge any other band that I do produce, I urge them to like, at least if you don't have a harmony on the chorus, just double it or triple it, preferably triple it or even quadruple it and pan them hard left and right. So it just sounds like a group singing. One, it adds to the dynamic, adds to the attention to the chorus,
mm-hmm.
but it also, I think, lends itself to that's the part that you're subconsciously cued to sing along to, you know, at like a show or when it's playing or whatever. Yeah. That's the way I look at it. And I always, I mean, it's a cheap trick, literally, but the dynamic, I think the dynamic still, it's almost a foolproof way to make the chorus pop out, you know?
I also think it's a fun way to watch a band too. That's what even Blackout started that too, where we all sing together. But Copyrights were another one, and Hospital Job, from like the videos I see, it's basically you and the other, there's a main guy that are both singing simultaneously. I love that stuff.
Yeah. And Tim's like good, like maybe we were just being lazy in Copyrights, but we were like, let's do unison most of the time, you know? Mm-hmm. Makes it sound fatter. But Tim's like good enough, and his range is like above mine anyway. So he's good. He almost harmonizes like the whole time that I'm singing. Yeah. And I remember even in Blackouts, you did quite a fair bit of harmonizing too, right? She harmonized with herself a lot too, I think.
Yeah. Eventually when the Lippmans didn't sing, but eventually when I got like Gub and Philip Hill, and like Philip Hill was a huge, he's a master at creating like choruses and stuff like that. And melodies.
I always thought I was, always in the studio when I recorded Phil, he was like the best backup vocal. Him and Zach from Dear Landlord were the two best backup vocalists because they could hit the notes, of course, but they got the phrasing. They copied the phrasing like almost exactly right with the lead singer. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's like a huge thing to make it not sound jarbled.
Yeah, I think Philip's thing is he just, you know, his mother worked at the Opry, at the Opera House. So he's got it in his blood. He's got that, you know, that's what sometimes when he, like, I understand him moving away from music for a while, but someone that's just that gifted and talented, you just want to keep them producing.
And I've always, ever since Matt Allison, always, when we recorded with him, every band we talked about, he would mention, like, the person that did the backup vocals as being the secret weapon, never like the lead vocalist guy. Mm-hmm. And I always thought that was interesting, but it was like, you might be onto something. I know the lead vocal is important, but almost equally important is the backup vocals. But
yeah, that seems to me, what are they? I'm trying to use this word more, but I can't even remember what it is. So I never use it. Not polemic, but it seems like a nice thing to say, but I think you still have to have a good front singer to it, but there is a secret to it. You know, there is.
Like we talked about Aerosmith. He's like, ooh, listen to Joe Perry right here. Talk about Van Halen. He's like, who's the bass player guy? He like literally is playing like one note through Running with the Devil. He's like, but his harmony, his backup harmonies make the song. I was like, all right, man.
Yeah. Well, then you have bands like Queen that's just like all over the place. They probably spend more time in the studio with vocals.
Never was a huge Queen fan, like too operatic or something, flowery. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Like, but I respect like the production, like studio stuff that they advanced was pretty amazing. And of course, like Freddie Mercury is just a natural talent.
Yeah.
Like, but never my favorite songs.
If you go back, if you ever have the time, because Queen is one of my favorite bands of all time, but I can kind of get that maybe. But the first few records, I would say 1, 2, and 3 are pretty like heavy and fast. And
no kidding.
Yeah. And they still have all those harmonies going, but it's a lot more.
I spoke out of turn probably because I listened to their the stuff that everybody knows, you know.
Everyone knows Bohemian Rhapsody and that, so that sort of period of the band. But the early stuff is, I don't even know how they got on a label, to tell you the truth. It's so bizarre, it's so weird.
Huh. Check that out.
Yeah, the second one is my favorite. I don't even think it's just Queen 2. Great record. It made me want to be a guitar player. That was my influences, was Brian May and Richie Blackmore from Rainbow and a lot of the.
So were you ever into punk stuff or no?
I got into punk when I saw Repo Man, the movie. So that was like in 85. Me and Matt Nelson went to go see that. And I think we knew the Ramones already and like the basics, you know, some Sex Pistols. But that did it for me. So I was into it, but it wasn't like when I went home and played guitar, it wasn't punk songs. It was it was more this New Jersey underground garage type scene. And then the Feelies.
Oh, okay.
Dump Truck. Zeitgeist is another one from around there. And REM sort of dabbled with that scene, and then they moved on to their own sort of sound. But it's kind of called the jangly guitar music, because it's
all right. I was just wondering, because you seem pretty eclectic, even back in even in Blackout, it was obviously pretty eclectic. But
yeah,
you didn't seem like the normal leather jacket 145 guy.
Yeah, I felt as a punk, it was my job. I like that stuff, but I. Like in interviews, when they'd go around and say, who's your favorite band, like old interviews where they didn't really have any questions of substance. They would just say, what's your favorite bands? And everyone in our band would pretty much say the Ramones. And I would go between like Jethro Tull or Traffic.
Did you get shit for that?
Yeah, not bad, but, but it was, I really did consciously feel like it was my job to like shake it up a bit from the beginning.
Yeah,
like
that. Absolutely. I'm sure that's one of the major dynamics that made Screeching Weasel work, you know?
Yeah. And that's why sometimes I'll say things like, oh yeah, the Ramones, they're like my 50th favorite band or something. But some of the tours when we were allowed to listen to music, Ben, later we couldn't listen to music at all. So.
You couldn't listen to music?
Yeah. There's no music allowed in the Weasel vehicle.
You have the patience of Job, my friend.
The good thing was we had good conversationalists. So
yeah, that's true.
That's one thing I always talk about, how I never really used to read Ben's lyrics, because when I did, I was like, oh, I know all this. We talked through all this shit already, so I don't, you know. I never felt the need to actually go back and look at all his lyrics.
Did he write all the lyrics in Screeching Weasel?
Yeah. The first two records, we sort of split it and then kind of discovered that he was more happy singing his own words. So I didn't think I was very good at it. I didn't become a really good short form writer until I joined the theater company here, Neo Futurists, which we write like 2 or 3 minute plays. And I sort of learned how to put
Is that different from too much light?
Yeah, too much light makes the baby go blind.
And is that the same thing, or is that a different troupe or whatever you call it?
Yeah, they're called the Neo Futurists is the name of the group, but the show was called Too Much Light Makes the Baby Go Blind. And every week we had to write new plays. They weren't improvised, they were actually written in like scripted plays. So you get really good at just digging into your brain and saying what you thought was a not really interesting thing becomes something interesting once you realize.
Then it's probably pretty easy to put that into lyric form after that, huh?
Yeah. Some of the first even Blackout songs were actually plays that I had done, like Love Cynical Style was a play that I did. And Summer Comes, which is one of our favorite songs that people like, was words for a play too.
I feel like it's once you have like a tangible idea to write about, it's the lyrics come a lot better than if you're kind of forcing. You know what I mean? Like, oh, I have this cool melody. I need to write lyrics to fit it. I don't know. Those ring more hollow to me than when I come up with it all at the same time, or when I come up with the lyrics first, even.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about that. Cause I know my process was, it's kind of split. It's not one way. Like the songs, sometimes I'll just play and words will come out. And those are like, If Leaving, which was one that I think Adam always wanted to cover. Well, one of our other songs. From Even in Blackout. So that one probably took me the same amount of time to write as it is to play. You know, like I created it when I was doing it.
A turn of phrase sometimes sounds musical or sounds like it needs to be incorporated into the song. And I think I do okay with wedging something like that in, or even if I like it more than the rest of the lyrics, just changing all the rest of the lyrics kind of thing. But I just feel like the way I write songs is there has to be some nugget of motive, something that really sticks out to me, whether it be guitar lead, whether it be a clever turn of phrase or a melody or whatever, something has to make it worth writing a song around, I guess that makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense. I work, it all comes at once. Like I'll write a whole record in like two or three weeks, but I'll go two years without even picking up a guitar or thinking about a song.
I don't know if I do a whole record in 2 weeks, but I know what you're talking about. Like sometimes it flows.
Our last one, our most popular one, Romantico, was pretty much me and Gub. I was in Japan. He was in, where is he living in? Louisville. And we just emailed ideas like all within like 2 weeks, we had the whole record.
Do you write all the music still? Or like did the songs he wrote lyrics for, does he write music?
Yeah. Once Gub came into the band, we started splitting responsibility. This Romantico was the first one where it was an even split. I think it was 7-7. Like we both had.
Makes it easier, right?
It does. Also, it makes it easier because he's so, I mean, I don't, Gub is such a lovely guy. He's so weird. Yeah. He's one of the most lovely, weird guys I've ever met.
Every time I've hung out with him, I've always had like a good conversation and always walk away being like, that guy's really nice.
Yeah. And he just gets really excited because I don't tackle a record unless I have a concept. Every record has to be it. I'm from, the Jethro Tull Queen traffic area where it's all like something holds it all together. You know, it doesn't have to be like a solid story, but like I was going to get to that, like your North Sentinel Island seemed to have that sort of, you had something going through it that was an idea that struck you. And I'm going to get to that in a second. I just want to finish this and we'll go back to you, all you. But Gub was the first one that got excited about that. I said, for one record, I go, I want to write a record about thresholds, like doorways. He goes, yeah. He came up with like five songs that had to do with that metaphor of being between two places at once, you know? So
nice. I like it.
And he was willing to go with that. So yeah. So that was my sort of segue into talking about you, because I read when this article about North Sentinel Island that you were sort of playing with that, like some theme sitting over the top of, or affecting all the songs. Not that it's a one story at all, but it just affects the writing of it. Talk a little bit about that. And did you do it on other records?
Yeah, that ever since that, like that one was about, a contrast of isolationism versus the ever increasing technological connection to the world, if you know what I mean, or modern world. And I feel like even since that album, it's ever since I've got, received a smartphone, I feel like it's kind of a pervasive theme through, like the last Hospital Job album is kind of about that stuff too. And but North Sentinel Island was pretty on the nose, but hopefully not too hit you over the head with it kind of thing.
Luke, you could very easily do everything yourself right there in your studio. What is it that between you and being in a band, what does that give you, do you think? Because you definitely have the talent to do the whole thing if you wanted. Is it just playing live, or do you get something out of being in a band?
Shit, John.
I'm sorry, you got to go?
No. Can you wait like 5 minutes? Or I can come back.
It was here that Luke had to leave for about 5 minutes because his father-in-law was working on the house with him. And we talked a little bit about that, but I think I cut it from this section about how we both like to help people that know what they're doing, but we don't ourselves exactly know what we're doing. We're, you know, him and I are from the touring duct tape culture, you know, where if you can't get duct tape to fix it, then you should probably hand it over to somebody else. But anyway, yeah, then when he came back, there was some kind of sound problem. It sounded like this.
But I think, like I said.
So I don't think you could understand his robot voice, which actually reminds me a little bit of his last record with Hospital Job, which has some really new wavy stuff going on in it. So the rest of the interview I had to take from a different Zoom file. So it goes to mono here, which I think is okay, because this is lo-fi interviews with hi-fi guests. So let's return to the end of the interview with Luke McNeil from Copyrights and Hospital Job.
So I was excited about the question I asked you, because I think it really links into what we're dealing with now, like where you don't get to be social as much and we don't get to be with our bands live as more. But you do seem to be someone who could do it all himself right there. What?
Oh, well, with Copyrights, I mean, I think Adam and Brett's voices are pretty crucial to that.
Yeah,
I don't think, I don't know if I'm I'm all right at holding the pitch, but I mean, my voice is definitely an acquired taste, not as strong as their two voices. So I mean, that goes back to the lyrics thing. Like, I don't, not that Adam's like not a person or anything, but I feel like it's definitely like a good instrument to put the words through, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That's a good filter for you. I kind of felt like I knew the answer to that in that way, because I feel the same way. Like, even if I wrote everything myself, that once you, I think I know this from working with ensembles in theater too. Like, once a writer brings something to the ensemble that, you know, if you allow it to, it alters and changes and grows in ways you wouldn't have seen. I feel like Brett does that too. And in like, he's one of the ones I was telling Adam that I watch when you guys play. I really like watching his guitar work, and he seems really into it and very focused.
Yeah. So he's a crucial part for sure. But I think, yeah, like I said, he's kind of flourishing as an artist now. So it might be hard to pry him away from doing art stuff to go on tour again too. I don't know, but we'll see how it goes.
Yeah. I'm going to wrap it up soon. Luke, but I want to hit, Adam gave me that last record that's unreleased. And
the copyright.
Yeah, I won't share it with anybody, because it's my own private gift from Adam. But it's great. I love it. I don't know all the records, listen to them enough to say it's my favorite, but listening to it is the one that impacted me the quickest, I think.
Thank you. I agree, man. I mean, I guess everybody thinks their last one's the best, but I'm really happy with all the songs on that. And me and Adam did it ourselves. We recorded the whole thing ourselves. So recorded the drums in my old basement, the one you stayed at, recorded guitars at Lost Cross in Carbondale, and then the rest between my house and Adam's. Adam's got a little studio set up too.
So I think he said the idea was.
So you listened to the whole thing?
I did. Yeah, I have it. I've listened to it a couple times. Yeah. Nice. I wouldn't be able to distinguish songs yet. I love that first song, Halo, I think is great. Okay. I think it's catchy as hell. I love some of the lines in there. I'm really bad at like listening to lyrics, but I actually have to see them on paper to try to actually grasp them. But I start feeling them before I actually understand them. But that song really hit me.
I'm kind of anxious to get it out into the world at this point. It's been like 2 years in the making.
I mean, yeah, I heard there was some stalling to begin with, and then the pandemic hit, and it just didn't seem to make sense to get it out.
I'm wondering if that was it's easy to second guess, but like a couple of my friends, I'm like, we're just going to wait till this is over with. And they're like, why would you do that? This is the time when everybody can listen to the most music. And as soon as this shit's over, there's going to be a million records released, which kind of makes sense too. But
yeah, I would say for myself, even in blackouts have never sold a lot, but just through Bandcamp during this pandemic, I've sold more than I have, I think, ever from of the band,
right,
just from doing it myself here. And the D-Cracks, I don't know if you know them, but they're committing to putting out their record in March. So I think a few bands are starting to peek their heads out that are like, we should just get these out. And
so, you know, those dudes, Mike and what's the singer's name?
Matt. Or Matthias. Or Matt. Yeah. Matthias. Yeah. They actually invited me out to play guitar with them at their, was it 10 year anniversary or 15? It was just last year in Vienna. Nice. It was amazing. So they learned like 20 Weasel songs that they probably already knew. And I learned a few D-Crack songs, and it was a lot of fun.
I like that his voice a lot. It's like good and gruff, but still melodic.
Yeah, he's an interesting fella in general. They're both that I just love getting to know bands, because you really learn how unique people are in general when you start to get to know them.
But the very first European tour we did, Mike was the drummer. Well, do you know the Zatopex, that British band?
Yeah.
He was their drummer on that tour, and fucking cracked me up so much every day. Been friends ever since.
He's a funny man.
I guess they can't come to America anymore.
Yeah, I'm doing a podcast with them in a couple of weeks, and I want to hit that story. I want to do a whole podcast just on that story, because it's...
That was the one that, I don't know if Adam talked about, we got like detained in fucking England and had to spend the night at the detainee prison at O'Hare, or not O'Hare, Heathrow.
I didn't know.
Yeah, I mean, it was they're like, oh, you can't come in. You don't have the right paperwork. We were so stupid. That was like our second time trying to sneak in as a band. Mm-hmm. And they're like, and there's no more flights to Chicago. So you have to stay the night, and you can't stay the night in the airport. So you have to stay in this detainee prison. They like locked us in and shit. I mean, luckily, luckily our roommates were like, Jeff was my roommate and Brett and Adam were together. So,
yeah,
but it's like, man, I couldn't handle real jail. I don't think that kind of spooked me, you know?
Yeah, we got luck. I'm sorry. With even in blackouts, we got lucky because we go in through Belgium, which is a lot more relaxed than that sort of aspect.
All of Eastern Europe, or I mean Western Europe, besides UK, you don't have to have any papers.
Yeah.
And but I was going to say America's just as bad, or if not worse. And the after our thing. And after, I don't know if you, when you go to Canada, it's a different, you have to have literally a different piece of paper every time, either going into Canada or coming back. And D-Cracks, I think they got in trouble trying to cross from Canada into the US. So I like wrote, I know I'm getting old. I like wrote on my congressman, and I'm an attorney. So I kind of know how statutes are laid out. And I like drafted a statute saying like Canada, North American, intranation artist exemption. Any artist that plans on making like less than a certain amount, you know, they treat every band like you're U2 or something, you know, you have to pay the same. So I wanted to make it so it was just a smooth process that didn't involve any fucking tax exemption or tax forms or 2.5 hours lost at the border for them going through all your stuff. And my guy is like a conservative guy, and I sent him that. I like, it took me like probably 3 hours to draft it up, and I'm like, here's just an example. I think this is it's not that big of a problem, but it is a problem for small time artists going between Canada and America, probably Mexico as well. And he sends back this form letter that says, yes, I'm concerned about illegal immigration as well, and I promise to beef up the borders, or like it was completely like the opposite.
Like, so didn't even really look at it. Yeah, probably,
he saw like the letter. Canada, the word Canada and Mexico, and probably said, "Oh, okay."
Yeah, it's probably some algorithm that saw some words and
built it.
So that was my that's why time. With for my 50th birthday, we made sure to get the Mangies here by like they came into different airports, different days.
Smart.
Like different states.
We did that with a French band that came over, and one of them still got fucking sent back. I had to play drums I played twice that tour. Not Scientists, they're like a French band, so I had to play all their songs too. And it was, and I mean, they were real careful. Again, went through different customs lines. I think they're all on the same flight, but so I think that's how they might have nailed them, but I don't know. Seems weird.
Yeah, I think I'm going to get into it with Mike, but I think from what I remember, he told me that he was the one that was caught, and he was separate from the gang, and they like looked him up on the computer. They like found a Facebook, and then they saw that he was in a band. Yeah.
And like Mike has told me countless times, and like we always say, we're probably going to spend more. We're going to give more in tax dollars to the country than, you know.
Yeah, we're going to be eating food and, you know, hotels and bringing, not making anything.
Bringing a few hundred people to a club, you know, like attracting to spend more money. I don't know. Whatever. But yeah, that was my last, not to get too political on you. That was my last bout of political activism.
To get a form letter back with a completely different topic.
Yeah. Hey, I tried.
Wow, this is actually this sets me up for the D-Cracks episode that I'm going to do, because we're going to discuss that. So this is a nice sort of lead into that podcast. So that's great.
Wait, tell Mike and Matthias hi for me.
I will. And Luke, thank you so much for this. And I'm digging both the hospital job and the copyrights stuff. So
yeah,
and I don't visit pop punk very often. And but your projects I always tend to enjoy quite a bit.
I appreciate that. That means a lot coming from you.
All right, Luke.
All right, man. Thanks a lot, John. All right. Take care, buddy.
You too. Bye-bye.
If you have made it this far, you have just got done listening to Darts by Luke McNeil's band Hospital Job from their 2018 album Haze Like Me. Thank you very much for listening to this coupled series of Adam Fletcher and Luke McNeil about copyrights and their other projects. Please, 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 if you can, support by going to our Patreon and becoming a patron for $2, $5, or $10. I'll thank you on the podcast, and if you pay $5 or $10 a month, you'll get special goodies and access to the... Patreon is doing these things where you can post videos just for your patrons, so I'm starting to do those, answering any questions that the patrons put to me, and I'm probably going to be doing those weekly, so... If you get, if you sign on to the, I think you have to be at the $5 range to get the free videos and also a button and a sticker. But I could really use, we can really use the help here. I'm very excited about getting many more podcasts done and also allowing myself the longer time it does to make the album dissections and the horror of the Polycephalia, which, speaking of, will be the next episode coming out. Episode 53 will be The Horror of the Polycephalia Part 4 with guest stars Dog Party, and also Miguel Chen will be returning back. Miguel Chen will be returning to the program. So thank you very much for listening. And remember to check out www.jugheadsbasementpodcast.com, or you can just go to PayPal if you want and give us a one-time donation at jugheadsbasement@gmail.com, and I will send you a personal email back, and thank you, thank you, thank you. All right, that's enough of that, and goodbye.